Welcome to Upland Lives. My name is Mike Rayne, author of Nature of Snowdonia and a provider of further training opportunities in CPD for mountain leaders and mountaineering instructors. I'm really pleased to have two very special guests today. I've got Stephen Helen Howe of Snowdonia First Aid and Snowdonia Mountain Skills. They offer a range of outdoor courses from mountain leader training to pretty advanced first aid stuff, actually. And they've got the experience to back it up, because these two are two of the most experienced real first aiders I've come across. They've been involved with mountain rescue for many, many years, and they're also into the dogs as well, the search and rescue dogs. So we're going to talk a little bit about search and rescue dogs. Besides that, they've walked the Munros. I think Steve might be on his second round. I might have even done them twice. And they're working their way through the Corbetts as well. So they're really active hill people, really experienced, both recipients of the Queen's Golden Jubilee Medal for services to mountain rescue. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Stephen Helen Howe today. How are you today, Stephen Helen?
Good.
Sorry, it's a sunny day.
Might be over your end, isn't it?
No, it tends to be sunnier on our side of the hills.
it's dismal
here.
Proper November clag.
Okay, so before we get into all that exciting stuff, I just want to know how you got started in the outdoors. How did the outdoors become a big thing in your lives, never mind a career?
Can I start off?
Helen, start.
My parents were into walking, my dad especially. And so for us, living up in the Ribble Valley, we're close to the Yorkshire Dales. So every weekend we'd go for a walk on Saturday in the Yorkshire Dales. And then all our holidays were the Lake District or Scotland. So dad took me walking and I just got the love for myself. So I then went on summer camps, summer youth camps, church camps in the Lake District. And over a few years, I then became a leader on those. And when I went to university, I was the vice president of the walking club at Durham, or what was known as the YHA club, because I had to change the name for some reason, but don't ask.
Yeah.
And Steve, I know when we first met, you were a pretty handy climber, weren't you?
Yeah. I started off, I lived on a grimy northern council estate and was turning into a bad lad. And as a kind of last ditch effort to redeem me, I got offered a free month at an outward bound course and discovered mountain walking and rock climbing. And it took off from there. And it's all I've ever been able to do, really.
That's brilliant.
Told me that before.
It's amazing what comes out in these conversations.
Yeah.
Did you know James Rebank then, Steve? He had a similar start, didn't he? Tough times around Penrith area.
I didn't know. I think he's probably a bit younger than me, but anyway, Penrith, we didn't mix with the kind of Lakeland, not very much.
Country lot, I get you.
Yeah.
Helen, you studied geography, didn't you? Did you go on to be a geography teacher? I know you're a geography tutor as well.
Yeah, so I went from, I actually wanted to go into the outdoors at university and go into outdoor education, but outdoor pursuits. But back then, there wasn't a lot. It was outdoor centres, usually local education centres from councils. And I couldn't get a job, so in the end, I just took my geography into a school and then got outdoors that way, because I had the D of E and I also had geography field trips. So I spent about 13 years in schools teaching geography, and then I moved my geography to the Field Studies Council in Battersea Coed, so I was able to take the geography outside a lot more. So places like Cumid Well or Mignant Moor or Crickieth all became my classroom, which was quite amazing.
Wow. And Steve, I guess, did you get into the outdoors really just to fund the climbing lifestyle, just to keep you in North Wales? Was it sort of an accidental thing?
It was pretty much, yeah. It's almost like I couldn't do anything else, so I just drifted into it.
Yeah. And I know, because I know you fairly well, that actually it was the people aspect that started to fire you up, wasn't it? And you realised that was something you wanted to do and make your career.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Cool. And there was a great coming together at some point, wasn't there, which changed both of your lives. I know, Steve, you were working in a large outdoor centre in North Wales. And
Large commercial outdoor centre.
Was it the coming together that created Snowdonia First Aid and Snowdonia Mountain Skills?
Yeah, we actually met years before, probably, I think it was 1997, we met on a search dog call out in Chester. And it was Christmas Eve, and I arrived there at about 5 a.m, and that was the days before everyone had sat navs and Google Maps. And I was driving along these dark streets thinking, how on earth do I find where we're supposed to be meeting? And then I saw this group walking along the road, and I don't remember this, but Steve, I stopped for instructions, and Steve said, oh, if you give me a lift back, I'll direct you to where we're supposed to meet. And then we didn't see each other for about 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
And met on a search dog weekend in Wales when the Welsh dogs hosted the English dogs.
Great. Well, that leads us nicely into SARDA, Search and Rescue Dog Association. Tell us a little bit about SARDA. What is SARDA? How does it work? What's your involvement?
Well, my involvement's not as much as it used to be because I've trained 3 search dogs, 3 mountain rescue dogs, and my latest is now 14 and a half. So she had to retire at 13. And I just personally, I can't train another dog till I lose her. I just don't think it would be fair to bring a young pup in and Clooney not to have the attention that she needs as she gets old. I know other dog handlers do it, I just can't. The Mountain Rescue Search Dogs, SARDA, started back, well, way back, probably 1970s. And it was Hamish McInnes who came up with the idea of avalanche dogs working areas rather than just working snow avalanches. So the English area dogs cover a lot more ground. They'll cover sometimes 1 kilometre, 2 kilometres squared on a call out. So it clears big, vast areas on the mountains. So really, it came about 1970s onwards, and it started as one organisation, and then it gradually split into more and more national or regional. So it went into Wales, England, Scotland, and then at some point the Scottish split, and they went into SARDA Scotland and the Highlands Scotland. And then Wales split into North and South Wales, and England split into the Lake District and the rest of England. The job is basically to look for missing people, but we do lowland as well as mountain searching in there.
Yeah, I was going to flippantly say that sounds like a lot more committee time when you create all those different organisations. But the dogs you send to find people wherever that may be, yeah?
Yeah. And so the idea is they work off rafts of skin coming off people, picked up in the wind. And then the dogs, as they cross the wind, they smell these little rafts of skin and then home in on it.
It's the bacteria on the skin that they're smelling. So fundamentally, you smell of rotten flesh to a dog.
Wow. Does it have to be a breed of dog?
Not necessarily, but we're emphatically like border collie kind of devotees. We just think, well, they're smart, and also they're built for the job of running around the hillside. So typically they'll qualify when they're younger, and they'll carry on working until they're older because they're not as prone to the back and hip problems that plague some of the other commonly used dogs like black labs and German shepherds, etc.
How did you get involved, Steve? What was your first experience with the search dogs?
As a climber, I witnessed a fatal accident and actually thought that after that I could get involved. I had something to offer, so I joined the Ogwen Valley Mountain Rescue Team, and then joined the search dogs because one of the other Ogwen Valley team members was very, very pro search dogs, so he encouraged me to join. I qualified a dog.
Did you have a dog at the time, or did you get a dog to do that?
We had dogs, but I kind of got a dog which was primarily going to be for search work. But, you know, it's almost like I was going to regard her as a tool. But, you know, that kind of lasted about 2 minutes, and she just became, you know, a beloved pet. Yeah.
Right. So you were with the Ogwen team for many years, Steve, and then the Flamberry's team, but you've stepped away from the mountain rescue now to concentrate on your own walking, really.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, was 20 odd years in mountain rescue, so I'd done my bit, so to speak.
That's enough.
And there's a certain extent of it, you know, being a young man's job, or it should be, except that the average age of mountain rescues is about 50 odd, I think.
I know, the thought of going back up Snowdon after a hill day, I just don't think I could do it anymore either. But you still do it, don't you, Helen?
Yeah, I'm still doing it, yeah.
And you're enjoying it?
But I do enjoy it, yeah. It's one of those things where if I've had a day doing a first aid course, sometimes it's lovely to just get out for a walk where you wouldn't normally go for a hill walk after you've finished a day's work. But it gives you the excuse. And I must admit, I get such a buzz out of working a search dog. There's a certain feel to watching your dog work an area. And I can't describe many of the things which give me that particular feeling. It's amazing. And I do miss it, yeah. But I'm still involved helping train some of the other dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully at some point I'll train another.
How do you train a dog? Does it have an aptitude that you coach? You know, you can't talk to it, can you? How do you do it?
You need a dog who likes people. So if you've got a dog who doesn't like people or who's scared of people, I'm not saying you'll never manage to train them, because my second dog was scared of people and I trained her. But she was never as good as the other two I've had, who absolutely adore people, and so that's half the battle. So you get someone to run out and they run out shouting and shrieking and making themselves really interesting, and then dive behind something like a rock or into a ditch. And dogs are curious, so when someone's been shouting their name and waving and making a lot of noise, and usually with a toy of theirs as well, then you release the dog and it goes after them. So every time you release, you use the same command, which in my case has always been find. And then this, you know, most dogs will actually find. It's like you find a lot of bodies, murder victims, if you like, are found by walkers and their dogs. But in their cases, it's because the dog finds something interesting and it won't leave it alone because it's not obedient enough to come back to the owner. Whereas actually, probably the search dogs are so obedient, they would come back to the owner. But this big secret for search work is training your dog to come back and tell you, to communicate to you that it's actually found someone. And in my case, I really concentrate on getting a good indication, which is a bark indication. And I've trained my dogs very much along the Lake District lines, which is you get the bodies of the people who run out and hide for us. And we get them to tell the dog to speak at their end with a toy. And then I call the dog back to me and tell it to speak. And then body calls it back, tells it to speak. And over a while, the dog develops a habit of this shuttle run between having found the person, running back to the owner or handler and barking to tell them, back to the body to bark, etc. Because I've concentrated so much on that bark, most of my dogs, even if they haven't barked immediately at the body end when they first find on a real search or in big areas, they'll bark on the way back to me. So it means I know that they've found. Whereas if people only train the dog to bark when they get back to them, then sometimes dogs can bark for all reasons, like hurry up, I'm bored, or I've been searching for the last hour, I haven't found anything, I'm bored, I'll get a praise if I bark. So you can develop what's called a false indication, which is where the dog just barks to get attention or praise. Because my dogs have been trained not to do that, they bark on the way back, I know whether they've found.
I know.
They've all been really good.
I know nowadays that the rescue teams can locate casualties using the mobile phones, using the Sarlok system.
Yeah.
We're talking to Russ Hoare, I think it's next week on Upland Lives.
Oh, brilliant.
I don't know we're recording this. So we did talk to Russ Hoare a couple of months ago before recording this, after recording this. That's a bit of a mess. Sorry about that. Anyway, Sarlok. So if you can locate somebody with a mobile phone, my question is, what's the point of dogs? Are they still getting used? Are they still a valid part of the rescue weaponry?
They are not used anything like as much as they were in the mountains. You know, the days of big mountain searches in England and Wales, I'm not going to say they're over, but they're certainly not as frequent. But if, I mean, a lot of the people we look for nowadays are more lowland areas, though they could be mountain, and we look for despondence and suicide. So you can only do a SARLOC on a phone where someone answers the phone and responds to the message, which says, click on this link. So if the person won't do that, or if they switch the phone off so we can't do, a zooming in on it from the mobile mast system.
Yeah.
And then if you go to places in Scotland, Scotland still has big mountain searches, because you've got glens which have no mobile phone signal. In the Lake District, half the time, if someone doesn't respond to your SARLOC when they're missing, you tend to think, especially if there's two of them, you think, oh, they're down in Eskdale, top end, upper Eskdale, because there's absolutely no phone signal up there. So dogs, you know, they still have a purpose. If someone falls and hurts themselves badly or they die, they're not going to respond to the SAR call. And therefore, again, dogs can be used there. But also, they help pinpoint. Sometimes we get a SARLOC on someone, and it gives you that area on the hill. But in the dark, it can still be quite hard to find them. So the dog can just make it quicker and pinpoint their exact location for us.
It's good to know. I'd certainly be very happy to be found by your dog, that's for sure. And do they carry brandy around the collars like the St. Bernard used to do?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
No Baileys.
Which I heard was a complete myth, that thing about the St. Bernard's and the brandy. That was Sir Edward Landseer who painted Monica the Glen.
That was
Unruh Etchkin Bothy. He visited the St. Bernard Pass, saw these dogs, which are fundamentally trail breakers, thought that's not very interesting. So he decided to kind of like sex them up a bit by inventing this little. Put all the brandy kind of flask, whatever, on the collar.
Brilliant. Anyway. Well, it'd be scotch in Scotland anyway, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So moving on a little bit, I'm interested in the Munros, because I don't know many ML providers who've walked the Munros, and it's always lovely when I get a candidate on a course who's done a lot of Munros. It really stands out. So, Steve, are you on your second round or third round?
Second, I suppose. I mean, I'll never finish them.
Because you're doing Corbett's, aren't you? So just so listeners are sure, I think most people know the Munros are the over 3,000 foot peaks. What are the Corbett's?
Peaks between 2,500 and 3,000 foot, with a slightly stricter definition than Munros, in that there's got to be a 500 foot drop, I think, on either side. So there are fewer Corbett's than there are Munros, but they tend to be more defined and more often trackless, so they're harder going on the whole.
And you tend not to get big ridges. So if you do the Munros, you can pick off, say, 7 Munros on the South Shield Ridge in one day, etc. Whereas the Corbett's, they're massive drops between each one usually. So it's a lot harder to pick up several in a day.
So a round of the 220-odd Corbett's is harder than the 280 Munros.
Wow, that's give us some examples. What are the famous Corbett's that aren't Munros that people might aspire to?
Oh, there's so many. Yeah.
Cobbler, and then all your sort of ascent hills like, crumbs.
Kunach, however you pronounce it.
Yeah,
Kunach.
Yeah. Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
And Sylvan. Is Sylvan one of those?
Sylvan's not even a Corbett.
Is it not really?
Graham, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, just like
the next one down.
Yeah. The Grahams are 2,000 to 2,500, are they?
I think so, yeah.
Brilliant. And how are you getting
we'll
on?
We'll never do those.
Sorry?
I have no chance. Yeah.
We'll never do those because too many of them are rounded, kind of peat boggy kind of things in the southern uplands. So.
Oh, yeah.
We've got, I think we've got about 5 Corbett's to go. And that was before COVID hit.
Yeah.
And then we've not actually really made many gains on them since, partly because Clooney's now so old, it's harder to get up them and we have to take it in turn. So quite a lot of our Corbett bagging over the last few years has been Steve heads off with Meggie in the morning Clooney and I then follow up the mountain track or up the glen. And then we meet Steve coming off the hill with Meggie. We do a dog swap, and Meggie then goes and does the Corbett for a second time while Steve and Clooney walk back down the glen. So Meggie probably, she's on almost double rounds of Corbett's.
You've got one tired dog at the end of the day. Okay, let's move on a little bit then. So how has the outdoor sector changed in your time? Because it's a different place, certainly, to when I know you and I started, Steve. And Helen, you started off in the field studies type world, didn't you? So how has it changed over the years?
Well, it's become much more mainstream, much more fashionable and popular, for sure, which is a good thing.
I think there's a lot more freelance mountaineers. So when I started,
wanted to take my qualifications outdoors, I don't think freelance outdoor instructors existed as such. It was all local authority centres. Mm. And then sort of late 1990s onwards, you sort of saw this surge of lots and lots of small businesses or sole trader MLs, thanks to things like the Three Peaks, et cetera, et cetera.
The internet happened, didn't it?
Yes.
That was the massive difference.
Social media.
Yeah. Everybody can have their own little business and website.
Do you find the people coming on courses like Mountain Leader Training have changed, and do you find you're training them in a different way for different things these days?
I think they've often got less experience than they used to have. For me, as far as training them in different ways, I think there should be vast more emphasis on the environment, on the political, social kind of issues around access, etc., and not so much Mike and Nav.
Most of the time, they're following paths.
Yeah.
And if you get
lost, and using exactly, using digital navigation. I don't know quite why the outdoor world at times are such a downer on digital nav. You know, I just think it's fantastic.
So long as you can navigate with a map and compass to back it up.
Yeah, I think we'd all say you need to be able to map and compass before anybody misquotes us, but it seems ridiculous carrying a computer that's worth several hundred pounds in your pocket and not actually using it, isn't it? Yeah. So that's one to come. You mentioned the environment there, Stephen. I know you've both got a particular interest in the upland environment. In fact, Helen, you're slowly working on the version of Nature Snowdonia for Scotland, the nature of the Scottish uplands. So, you know, how did you get into the upland environment, and do you have a particular interest in it, and how does that pervade the work that you do?
For me personally, being a geographer, I've never been a human geographer, so all the population stuff and urban geography, relevant as it is, just never ever interested me. So even as a geography teacher, I tended to teach a lot of the physical geography to our sixth form. And I think for me, the reason I went into geography was actually what was back then called a fourth year rather than year 10. I'd done glaciation that year. And then in the summer holidays, I went on one of the camps in the Lake District. And suddenly the glaciation just came alive, seeing the U-shaped valleys of the glacial troughs, the pyramidal peaks, corries, etc. And for me, that was like, oh, wow, it's living stuff. I can see it. So I think I've always personally had that interest, and that's why I became a geography teacher. And but I must admit, lockdown opened my eyes even more, because we were basically having to do the same hill over and over again, which for us, because Snowdon was closed, the only mountain accessible to us was the Lydabower. And so we were going up a little hour, sort of taking it turns almost every other day. And I started seeing stuff that I've never noticed before, which was all the periglacial side. So everyone goes on about glaciation, but the periglaciation has changed a lot of the mountain areas since glaciation. And I was walking along going, Gordon Bennett, it's a soliflexion lobe. I don't believe it. Look at that soliflexion lobe. And then seeing patterned ground on the summit of Lydabach, where I could see stone polygons, vague stone polygons and stone stripes and things like that. So it just made me see the outdoors even more. And I've always thought physical geography in the outdoors as being a detective. Sometimes you don't get the right answer, but you try to explain what you can see. And there's normally a good explanation for most things. And I think that interest sort of then spilled over into me thinking, well, no one's done the Scottish Highlands, and we spend a lot of time up there. We love it. So why don't I write a book about Scotland? And I've got to confess, it's got me far more into the birds and the plants as well, because I was very much a physical geographer, but I didn't tend to notice the flora and the birds quite as much. And it's really got me interested in that a lot more.
Yeah, and the more we do, the more we find out, don't we? It's a continuum, isn't it? So you walk far and wide across England, Scotland and Wales. What differences do you see? So, for example, how would you say the upland management varies from Wales to the Lake District to some of the more remote parts in Scotland? The hills have quite a different feel, don't they?
Yeah, not so much of a difference between Snowdonia and the Lake District, though. Mm. I think Snowdonia tends to be rocky, so you don't have, not quite so green. But obviously there's a big difference between those two areas, and especially in the northern half of the Highlands. A lot of people think of them as still being kind of natural, if you like, but they're subject to human interference, as the others are. Fundamentally, when it comes down to it, is red deer.
And certainly, it's more the southern Highlands, you still see very Lake District-y type hillsides, which are just grass because of all the sheep grazing. But when you get further north, there's not as much sheep grazing. So then you start to see a lot more of the matte and purple moorland grasses, and then you also get the deer estates and the stalking estates, so you get a lot more bracken, heather and things like that further north. Well, not necessarily bracken, but certainly heather.
Do you find it challenging when you say to people you're training that this is not a pristine natural wilderness, and in some areas it's probably just been a little bit overused, yet at the same time recognising there are people who are invested in farming and deer stalking and things? How do you manage that dichotomy while you're training people in the hills?
I think kind of fundamentally don't polarise it and say one's right, one's wrong, but just give people as much information as we can, and they're fundamentally got to make their own decisions from their own opinions.
And I think one thing we've noticed is when I first started walking, shooting season for the stags and the deer in Scotland, it was almost no go in the mountains. There was no compromise. I can remember one day walking in 10K along roads and tracks to get to where I wanted to access the mountain, which was Skerdo in Torridon, to be told by the stalkers, no, we're up there today, you can't go up there. So having done the concrete or tarmac walk at the beginning of the day, thinking at the end I wouldn't have any tarmac, I then just had to walk out again along all this tarmac. When we've been up to Scotland in stalking season since then, quite recently, we've actually found the head keepers and the stalkers, they're happy to compromise and chat to you. So we went up one estate and the guy was amazing. He just said to us, where are you walking today? And when we told him, it was like, oh, that's great. Can you do me a favor? And can you come down that route rather than this route? Because then I'm shooting around the corner. And that way we both keep ourselves separate and we don't interfere with each other. And we're staying in a body which actually belonged to their estate. And he was saying, have you got enough firewood? I can bring more firewood
for you.
Amazing. Yeah, and it's there has been a sea change. Maybe it's we've been looking on the estates we've walked on, but I think the shooting estates, as in the deer estates, are actually a bit better with access nowadays than they used to be. I wouldn't like to hazard the grouse estates maybe.
No, that's probably another question for another time. I want to stay on a positive note, which you've just delivered nicely there. One of the last things I want to ask you about is people who are coming on mountain leader training courses. What advice would you give them? What would you like to see them be better at, more experienced at? How can they prepare themselves better to be mountain leaders?
Do lots.
Yeah.
I think it always, One question on social media, which I always have a bit of a gripe with, maybe that's not the right word, but it's when people say, oh, I need to get more QMDs, give me a suggestion of QMDs. Mm. And I'm thinking, we never used to worry too much about QMDs. I didn't when I was doing my qualifications, because I was just out all the time, out in the mountains nearly every weekend. And I think it's, I've seen you reply this on one of those questions, saying something along the lines of, if you enjoy walking and you're out there, you don't actually struggle getting your QMDs. No, so maybe some people are going too quickly. They're almost running before they can walk because they think, oh, this is great. I want to be a mountain leader. Mm. I think sometimes people need to just spend a bit longer getting those QMDs, which then gives them the confidence and just gives them more experience in the hills.
Go and walk up hills you've never been up is basically what it boils down to, isn't it? And just, I should mention first aid first, because you're two of the most experienced and best known in the business. Would you have any advice for anybody on the first aid front before we finish?
Ironically, rather than rather than try and promote first aid courses, don't worry about it so much, really, because stuff hardly ever happens. It's very easy to paint this picture that the mountains are really, really dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. But statistically, it actually doesn't appear to be so. And most first aid issues are pretty minor.
I'm going to
think about keeping people warm.
Steve. Yeah, don't overthink the first aid. Keep people warm and look after them. So thank you very much indeed, Steve and Helen, for talking to us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm going to end the recording at that point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, cheers, Mike.
Cheers.